WGN. Here's Elise Glink from Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Hi, Elise.
Hey, John.
Okay, so let's start on Friday's number. The Consumer Price Index was up again. That's not breaking news, but what are we hearing about it since?
Well, what we're hearing about is seeing what's going on with the economy just in general and how Wall Street has responded to that news on Friday with a very strong upward push. I think part of this is, well, the economy is really strong, so earnings numbers, which start this week, are looking to be strong as well. So there's a lot of momentum in the stock market after a couple of weeks of, gee, what's the Fed going to do, and where are interest rates going, and housing doesn't look so great. And now suddenly, you know, as the stock market is often, a flip for them and moving in a very strong direction.
Yeah. But then the Fed is more likely to certainly not lower interest rates, keep them or raise them, huh?
No, they think they've priced that in, the stock market. I'm sure if you asked people there, well, you know, what about interest rates going up? They'd say they'd price it in. But it was interesting because, you know, assuming that the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates, and that's what they said they're going to do, that they've got at least another one or two upward rate moment moves coming, maybe as early as next year. This morning, Fannie Mae issued commentary from its chief economist, Doug Duncan, to say that they are now expecting a mild recession in Q1 2024 based on high interest rates. The reason they take that perspective, of course, is because the mortgage market and housing market is kind of stalled, with not sellers not wanting to give up their low interest rates, so they're not putting their houses in the market. People can't buy houses. Housing prices keep going up as interest rates are going up, so that limits the number of first-time buyers who can enter the market. And, of course, housing is such a strong driver of the economy, so they have some concerns about how this little party can keep going.
But did you say that home prices have been going up this year?
I know. This is, again, the never before. I talked about this at the end of 2022, that we were in the land of never before, because what typically happens is when mortgage interest rates go up, people, you know, stop buying houses and prices fall. And that's what should have happened. But instead, we're going to see home prices rise almost 7% this year, even with mortgage interest rates. And that's because we simply don't have enough houses for people to buy. We're still about 5 million short.
Yeah. So the pressure of lack of inventory is greater than the pressure that interest rates exert on potential buyers.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird, confusing market at the moment, I have to say. And I feel for everybody who wants to buy a house, because the cost of buying a house this year over last year, it's like 40% more in terms of what it'll feel like coming out of your pocketbook. So what ends up happening is simply that people spend less for houses, but since housing prices are going up, you're getting even less when you go out to find the house of your dreams.
Well, I know some people that are sitting on properties that they're maybe anxious isn't the right word, but they're wondering when they're going to put it on the market. And if they're not going to do it now, I wonder what an expected interest rate hike next year is going to do to the sellability of those homes then.
Yeah, I think what you're looking at is people who will sell their homes for a higher price and not need to get a mortgage. They're the ones who are actually doing deals more than people who still need a loan. So
yeah,
if you are buying in cash, it's golden for you.
Is it, I don't know, how do you score the probability of a recession next year, Elise?
I think we've had an incredible amount of underlying strength in this economy, John. There was an interesting article last week that said that one reason, which may have escaped people's notice, is that seniors have more money available to them right now. Why would that be? Well, seniors, counting anybody above age 60 for some ways of doing it, or 55, these are the boomers and the older of generation Gen X who are in those homes with those super low interest rates. Their kids are now out of college or, you know, getting through college, so those expenses are down, and they suddenly are in homes that are cheaper owned. They're still working. And so the strength of their money seems to be coming into play to keeping things bubbling in the economy. And so I wonder if we are going to see a slowdown. I do think we're going to see a slowdown, whether we get into a technical recession or not, with a couple of quarters of negative growth plus some others. I think it depends on how hard that generation and their kids are getting hit by repaying student loans. We still haven't seen the effect of the repayment cycle that just started October 1st.
Yeah.
And we know that the government and a lot of the lenders are having trouble restarting that program. I think I talked about that with Lisa Dent last week. And so not everybody's getting the correct invoices. Not everybody's starting to repay them. So I think it's going to be a couple of months before we see how many people are repaying and what that looks like. In addition, the Biden administration has said that even if you're a little late in paying your student loans for the next year, it will not be a negative on your credit history. They don't want this stuff to start immediately hitting credit histories. And so there's another year where the slow payment or repayment cycle that's kind of building in and just restarting, where that won't cause a negative action, which means if it did, of course, your interest rate on your credit cards would go up. Your auto loan might change. Or if you got a new car, the auto loan would be higher. So I think the Biden administration's trying to do what it can to keep that lower. But that said, lots of people have credit card debt, and that credit card debt is now pushing, you know, from maybe 8.99% to 19% interest, and that's a pretty hefty fee as well to start paying. So to get back to your question, John, I do think we're going to have some sort of a hit. First quarter is likely, simply because that's when all the Christmas bills come due. We'll see if that happens.
And I haven't heard any word to the contrary that student debt is still not discharged in a bankruptcy, right?
They're trying to make that easier. Right now, you can discharge it if you are really, truly destitute. It is a pain in the neck to do. It is hard to do. It's very tough to prove, but it can be discharged. But the Biden administration is working to make that easier. I still don't think we have a great way of doing it yet. It's easier to discharge other kinds of debt. Student loan debt is pretty hard.
You all had an article at Best Money Moves, Three Ways Financial Stress Impacts Employees. Financial stress impacts, well, anybody, but what's the employee angle here?
Well, you know, Best Money Moves, which is my financial wellness company, we actually, you know, sell our technology, which helps with financial literacy and helps people make better decisions with their money, kind of like what we do every week with you, John. But what we do is focus on how companies can help their employees, because it's a big ROI for the employer, right? Your employee, if he or she is financially stressed, causes physical health issues, which raises your healthcare premium costs for the company. That's a big problem. It can cause just harm employees' mental health and self-esteem. So we've just had Mental Health Day, and when people are financially stressed, these things are tied very tightly together. Money and mental. You can imagine you're up in the middle of the night thinking about your money. It's really bad. You're worrying about how you're going to pay bills. And so companies that help their employees manage their financial stress, lower it by providing them with, you know, education, financial literacy education, but also what products and services and benefits that they're already giving them can help, is big. And then finally, when you start to help reduce mental stress caused by money issues, you help employees feel more connected to their own company. And so what you end up seeing is the company employees who are financially stressed, like 33% say that makes them feel distant from their company. It makes them look for another company to go to. And it's so expensive and difficult to find employees. So employers should want to keep their employees connected, productive, feeling better, feeling good about their lives, and of course, feeling comfortable that they can meet their financial needs.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the headline on your website. Financially stressed employees feel less connected to their company. I had never thought about it that way, but I guess that makes sense. If you feel adrift, maybe you don't see the employer as the life raft they may be, either you're going to be casting around or you're just not grounded. You're not rooted very well, are you?
No. And according to PwC's latest report on financial wellness, more than half of employees say they've experienced decreased self-esteem and mental wellness due to their financial stress. It really impacts people at every level, which is why we're just out here trying to help.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves, thinkglink.com to find out more. Elise, we'll talk another Monday. Thanks for your help.
Always a pleasure, John.
On WGN, here's Jim Dahlke, the national editor at American Inno. ChicagoInno.com is a good website. Hey, Jim, how are you today?
Hey, John, doing great. Thanks for having me.
You always talk to us about angel investors and venture capital and innovative companies in the tech sector. I'm kind of intrigued by this one. I got to tell you, Capella is, I don't know, either a beautiful thing or for crying out loud. What's the matter with you people?
Yeah, John, Capella, this is an app out of Boston. Really interesting premise. So what they have done is they say that they have created what is essentially an AI-powered baby cry translator. It's kind of a similar business to Shazam. If you've ever used the Shazam app on your phone, what it does is can tell a song that's playing in a store or at a restaurant. You tap the button and it shows you what song it is. And essentially what Capella is doing is making that, but for your baby's cries. So what it says it can do is listen to the type of cry coming from your baby and determine right there if it's a hungry cry, or maybe it's a dirty diaper cry, or maybe something a bit more serious like the baby is in pain. You know, this is an app that's going to launch in November, and so they're right around the corner here to launch date. It's built from an MIT engineering grad, and really what they want to do is kind of replace the traditional baby monitor. So you think, you know, while you got your baby monitor on in the middle of the night, it goes off because you can hear your baby crying. And what Capella aims to do is not just let you know, hey, your baby's crying, but also give you an additional layer of information. It's, hey, your baby is crying, and it's likely because they are hungry or likely because they have a wet diaper. So taking a really big swing here at the baby space, I have a three-year-old, so I know very well, you know, what it means to kind of wake up in the middle of the night because your baby is not feeling very well. And, hey, if you knew a little bit of information as you were running into the bedroom, that might be kind of nice.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, having listened to you describe that, I have a almost three-year-old granddaughter, and I had a couple of sons, and you're absolutely right. I still do have a couple of sons, but they're older now. They're having their own babies. But the point is, you can't tell the difference pretty quickly between what kind of cry it is that your kid is giving, right? I mean, you would know that.
Certainly. And I think what this is perhaps most aimed for is brand new parents in the earliest days, right? As you're trying to get your feet underneath you, you're still sort of figuring out the ropes and learning where you're going here and getting a sense of, yeah, hey, what do I spring into action here for? You know, I think what it is right is, you know, just another tool in the tool belt for parents here, right? And a chance to get a little bit more information. So time will tell if the market responds to this. Like I said, the launch date is coming out next month. So you can sign up for the waiting list if you're an interested parent right now. But we'll see how the market reacts and if Capella can really catch on with parents.
Oh, so it's in beta right now? Are they still testing it?
Yeah, launch date is November, so they say they're ready for launch next month, and they've got a wait list for those who are interested in being an early user.
Mm. Okay. VC struggles to fundraise. Is this a Chicago story or a national one?
Yeah, it's definitely both a Chicago and a national story. You know, what we you know, we often sort of measure the health of startups in the tech sector based on the amount of money that startups raise. We also look at the health of the sector based on the amount of money that their investors are raising. And so we took a look at some data on how much venture capitalists in the U.S. have raised through the first three quarters of the year. They've raised $42.7 billion for the first three quarters of this year. $42.7 billion might sound like a lot of money, but that's actually well off the pace of last year, which brought in $172.5 billion. That was a record, actually, throughout the U.S. So this year is actually on pace to see the least amount of venture capital raised in the U.S. since 2017. Kind of what that shows is that, you know, hey, we saw a huge boom, you know, during the pandemic years of 2020 through, you know, early 2022. The numbers of fundraising are now kind of not even quite matching pre-pandemic numbers. So, you know, that's really an example of the lack of startup exits we've seen. So the IPO window has been basically not existent for startups. So few startups have been able to go public in recent years. And what that means is fewer wins for investors. You know, big late-stage venture capital funds have just not been able to recoup, some of those winnings yet. And so at the end of the day, those funds are not exactly ready to reload and bring in more funding for startups for the years to come. So what that could result in is even decreased funding for startups in the years to come.
But are you saying that as a result of the pandemic, there are just fewer horses to bet on, you know, less companies with resources or ability to actually get something going? So I wonder what the percentage is that they're batting, you know?
That's a great question. I think it's a multi-pronged effect, right there. As startups continue to
Santa here, as the holidays draw near.
Don't know why that was going, but keep going, Jim. You're making good sense there.
Yeah, startups are shutting down at higher rates, right? We've seen the shutdown rate increase post-pandemic, so we know that there are fewer VC investable businesses. VCs raised, like I said, record venture capital last year. So, these funds have raised over the last couple of years, and what we're seeing is that, the investors are just kind of sitting on the sidelines a bit as they sort of wait for the IPO window to open and, recoup some wins there from startups, especially at the later stages. So, hey, we're going to have to wait to see some more startups hit the public markets, I think, before we see investors really gear up with those big funds.
One last thing. Talk to me about this 3D printing company in Skokie.
Yeah, speaking of funding for a startup, Chicago startup Azul 3D, this is a startup here that does 3D printing. They create these really interesting 3D printing machines that they say can print with really limitless scale and super speed. Essentially, it's super fast 3D printing. They've got $15 million in the bank here. Nice chunk of change for the startup that's growing out of Skokie. And what they are able to do is kind of for electronics manufacturers and personal medical devices, they're able to 3D print really quickly. And so a lot of 3D printing right now is kind of used for prototypes. And what Azul 3D says is, hey, we can get you way far beyond prototypes and get you some serious scale with 3D printing with their machines.
Hmm. Good to know. And always good to hear you. Jim Dahlke, national editor, American Inno, bright and bushy-tailed, even though he's got a three-year-old who he's... Actually, by now, sleep is not an issue, right? You're all probably getting through the night pretty easily, right, Jim?
Oh, yeah. We're a sleep veteran at this point. So, yeah, long past us.
Good to hear, and thanks for your thoughts today.
Thanks, John.
That's Jim Dahlke from American Inno. To have more business news time now with another report, here's Dave Schwann.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The U.S. Small Business Administration has ranked Byline Bank fifth among lenders nationwide in loan volume at the close of the SBA's fiscal year, September 30th. It's the 15th year in a row Byline, based in Chicago, has received recognition by the SBA. Are you a Rite Aid pharmacy customer? The pharmacy chain has filed for bankruptcy and obtained nearly $3.5 billion in financing to carry out a restructuring plan. To cope with falling sales, Rite Aid will also close what they term underperforming stores. Average gas prices around Chicago are down over 8 cents a gallon from last week. Gas Buddy reports average prices come in at $3.75 a gallon. That's just over 40 cents a gallon lower than a month ago and over 80 cents a gallon lower from a year ago. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Dave Schwann.
Okay, Steve Alexander, business of food, please.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. It's truck season. A Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, on the phone with us is...
Yeah, my name is Javon Nicholas.
Hi, Javon. So your phone rings and...
At first, I didn't answer the call. I thought that it was spam because it showed up as Chicago Bears on my phone. Well, yeah, right.
It was not spam.
She said that Egg Rose ETC was nominated for their Chicago Bears All-Pros and that we won.
And that means for this month, Egg Rolls ETC is getting the power of the NFL behind it.
Free marketing opportunity for my business. For my small business that I could not afford, especially the Chicago Bears, to be featured on their website. They might even give me a shout out at the game. Who knows? Wouldn't that be great?
6 years in business and going strong for Egg Rolls ETC. And the keys to success?
Not giving up. being creative, researching different ways to network and ways to serve my product.
And these are not your typical egg rolls and pot stickers.
I love Chicago, so of course I had to create our version of a Chicago-style Italian beef pot sticker. A spinach and cheese lasagna, field pot sticker. We have that as well. We have apple pie crescent.
And even one containing collard greens named after her grandma, Gert.
Reminded me of a comforting feeling of picking collard greens and other vegetables out of our garden growing up in our house.
You can buy them online at eggrollsetc.com or in a bunch of restaurants and stores around town, including at Pete's Fresh Markets.
Yes.
And since you are the Chicago Bears Small Business All-Pro, will Bears fans be able to buy them at games?
Not yet, but who knows? Wouldn't it be cool to have one of our Buffalo chicken egg rolls served at a Bears game? I think so.
Javon Nicholas of Egg Rolls ETC.
Egg rolls are trending.
EggRollsETC.com, the Chicago Bears Small Business All-Pro this month. On the food calendar, today is World Food Day and National Liqueur Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Sarah Cox joins us. Curator of exhibits at the Elmhurst History Museum. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You guys are everywhere. A lot of nice coverage about this exhibit. My goodness.
I know. It's very exciting. I'm so pleased that everybody's enjoying it.
Well, in fact, when I saw it promoted, I don't know if I saw it in a newspaper or on TV the first time, I thought, what a good idea. I want to go. We are talking about the department store exhibit at the museum. What made you all decide? Did you all curate this, or are you just housing it and somebody else is doing it?
We curated this. We've in the past had this great partnership with author and historian Leslie Goddard, and she has worked with us with a number of exhibitions. One in particular was Sweet Home Chicago, and it was most recently she came out with the book Lost Chicago Department Stores. And we thought this was just another great time for a partnership with her. Her knowledge and expertise really are the center point that really pair nicely with all the artifacts and photos that we have in the exhibition. So most of the artifacts come from us or from Leslie. We have a few pieces on loan from Macy's, from their Marshall Fields archive. So, I mean, it was kind of the great time for a perfect partnership again.
Everything Carson Perry Scott and Marshall Field. Are those the two stores or do you have more?
We have more. So we have kind of our palaces of shopping, Marshall Fields and Carson Perry Scott. We have our mail order kings, which are Sears and Montgomery Ward. We have our neighborhood stores like Weebolts and Goldblatt's. And then we also take a look at, you know, out here in the suburbs, we had department stores too. Here in Elmhurst, we had the Elm, Allswang's, and Ruby's.
Now, some of these, there still are Sears department stores brick and mortar, right? So
they are online, along with Montgomery Ward's also holds an online platform as well.
I'm just wondering, so what's the criteria? Do you have to be no longer in operation brick and mortar, or are you not scoring at that club? Because I don't remember seeing a Weebolts or a Goldblatt's forever.
Yeah, I mean, what we looked at is we wanted to look at just department stores. So these are stores that were operated under one brand name. They had departments from clothing to housewares to furnitures. Sears, I mean, they had great brands like Kenmore and Craftsman. And what we really looked at was kind of going earlier to the history of department stores, starting all the way back in 1840 when Lake Street was the original shopping district in Chicago. However, it was after the Chicago Fire that we started to see the rise of the new shopping district on State Street. So what Leslie looked at in her book and what we focused on as well in our exhibition were stores that popped up during this crucial time in the 1880s and 1890s and were part of kind of that State Street, that Great Street shopping district that occurred. And most of these, kind of the top six that we feature here, are ones that really played out well on State Street. You know, Chicago was home to about 8 different department stores. You know, you look at other cities like New York and Detroit and San Francisco, and they had a similar thing. You look at Macy's in New York. So we really just wanted to focus on those early stores that got their early beginnings, especially at the late 19th century.
So how different would a department store from the late 1800s be from one late 1900s or the 2020s?
Well, I mean, if you look at department stores today, when you go to them, like a Kohl's or a Von Maur, you're going to have one floor, and it's going to have multiple different departments. Now, imagine going into like a Marshall Fields, and one floor is just gloves. Or you go to the fifth floor, and it's just women's wear and hats. So they had a lot more different sections, and they occupied a lot more different floors. And so they have a lot of departments today we wouldn't see today, much like a glove department, or probably as many restaurants. You know, we go into these stores, we're in, we're out, we want to make it a quick experience. Back in the day, they wanted people to stay in their store all day. So places like a Marshall Field had places for you to eat. They had post offices so you can use their stationery. They had phones when they came to be more accessible. You could use their phones. They had nurseries so that your kids can be watched while you're shopping. They wanted it to be an all-day experience. Well, today we're kind of in, we're out, and we're home. We know exactly what we needed, and we're not kind of hanging around for the day. So there's that kind of change in shopping attitudes as well.
Amen to that, I'm about to say, although I don't know, maybe that era sounds a little more relaxed, a little less stressful, even though they could not have had, you even make it sound like they have as many goods, or at least deeper in some categories. They didn't have consumer electronics like we know now, so it's very curious, the difference and the similarities.
It is. And, you know, they were always willing to change with the times. You know, early on, Carson's and Marshall Fields were considered more conservative, so they were a little bit slower to change. But places like Sears and Montgomery Ward's, who basically were taking their items for the catalog, because they started off as catalog stores. They didn't have a storefront until much later. They had a lot more to offer, and they were out there to try, because they were offering things like typewriters and farm equipment. Their category of customer was that customer in the rural area, while Marshall Fields and Carson Perry Scott were really trying to get the people who were coming downtown. They were using the new forms of transportation. Then, you know, women had a newfound freedom. They were out shopping. They were going to get the vote. So it's just a different lifestyle than what we see today.
So when I come to the Elmhurst History Museum and see this exhibit of department stores, am I going to walk through like mock-ups of them, like pop-up Montgomery Wards?
What you'll see is we do have a lot of photographs from different archives. We have fashion displays, so much like you used to see back in the department stores where you had the mannequins with different dresses and hats and outfits. We have those from Marshall Fields, Carson Perry Scott, Montgomery Ward, and Sears. You're also going to see kind of some smaller items, like early credit cards. They're called credit plates. You're going to see early forms of invoices. You're going to see how each of these department stores cater to their audience and where they had their humble beginnings to kind of end up on State Street, part of that culture of shopping on State Street.
It just opened up, this exhibit. Is it being well received?
Extremely well. There's not a time that I'm not just wandering around in the gallery and someone doesn't stop to tell me just an awesome story about how they used to work for one of these department stores. Their parents work there. They tell me their experience at Christmas time, going to, you know, the Walnut Room or seeing the Christmas windows. We do have a Christmas display in here. Macy's was generous enough to loan a few of their pieces from their 2004 window to us. And so we have those live and animated in our gallery for people to see. So,
do you have Frangomints? Are there any Frangomints here?
We do have a display of Frangomints. We don't have any to eat, but I do have a little scent station, so you can pick up this little thing, and it smells exactly like Frangomints.
Okay. fair enough. Well, what an interesting, fun exhibit. Sarah Cox is the curator of exhibits at the Elmhurst History Museum. ElmhurstHistory.org. All right. Nice to talk to you. Well done, Sarah. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.